This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Priseman. I am delighted to be joined today by my friend, Jetsy David Fax, who is a senior editor at Vulture, where he works at the site's comedy critic and serves as the chief curator of the magazine's event series. He's also the host of the hit podcast Good One, where he interviews comedians about their process. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and his book is called The Comedy Book. Welcome, Jesse.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Ah, it's so good to talk to you about this. I've been waiting. I think I want to start with the idea that common wisdom is that studying a joke too hard makes it unfunny. And yeah. I feel like it's your life's work to disprove that idea. And so you have your Vulture stuff and the podcast, and now you have this book to convince us. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, I just sort of wanted to do it once. And I thought, I did it. Who knows? But it's the first time I ever tried to explain how a joke worked or how a sketch worked. And I was like, I had an insight on it and I wanted to do it. And then someone was like, you shouldn't do it. Like, I think editors were like, well, you can write about comedy, but you shouldn't sort of explain why something's funny or something like that. And I had commenters who were sort of like, you're not supposed to do this. While other people were like, enjoy the article. And then once people said you couldn't do it, I'm not like that type of a person. But I did sort of, I was clear. I was like, I am doing it. Clearly can. And then what I sort of saw was like, once I put my level of sort of thinking towards comedy, it lived up to my sort of, I wouldn't say scrutiny, but lived up to my level of obsession. There sort of was so much to talk about and think about. And, you know, I had listened to sort of the podcast where comedians do that, but felt like, there's not enough. Like, it's not going deep enough. They might not have the sort of critical vocabulary to sort of discuss things, because comedians are ultimately limited by their sort of personal experience. So they have to talk about in terms of like, how do I get through this weekend or whatever, where I can be more detached. And the more I did it, the more I was able to reveal. And then like, I sort of just sort of built a base of it. And then through the podcast, somewhere along the way, comedians were like, okay, cool, you can do this. We can do this. We're going to do the one thing we're not supposed to do. Because I think a lot of comedians had been desperate to be taken seriously. And be it because of some sort of childhood trauma or because they're comedians. But they just sort of like, they're like, we're working really hard. And I think I did a good job, you know, and I want to be seen and I want to be paid attention to. And I just sort of like, you know, I've done, let's say 200, I have no idea. And everyone is different. They contradict each other. They'll be like, all comedy is this. And the next one's like, well, actually comedy. And that's the goal. The goal has always been like, there's such a range. There's no one way of doing it. And that's what's so exciting about it.
I love that. And you really make the case that comedy is an art form that we should be paying attention to, just like any other art form. And I love, Jesse, that your intellectual endeavor of writing about comedy includes so much theory. And I your notes section for this book is intimidating.
Is it?
Tell me about that. Tell me about putting together all the theory stuff while talking to regular dummies. No offense.
No problem. Well, there's a few things. One, when I set out to have all these things to reference, I forgot that I'd also have to do all these footnotes or all these end notes. And I was like, I wish I didn't write a book like this. But it is because like over the course of the years, I had met or interacted with comedy academics, and there's not many of them And I got a sense of frustration that they were not taken seriously in academia. They're very often, if not, I think every single one of them essentially has to sort of like do comedy academia as a sort of side gig. And I thought they had so many interesting things to say, right? So then I was like, well, they've already said so much. Like, and I'm not going to pretend to rewrite what their opinions were. So then I tried to collect all the things I thought are really interesting that sort of fit into sort of my general topics that I already knew I wanted to get into. So there's like the chapter I was already going to write about timing and how comedy is used to process tragedy. And like, you know, I was writing a chapter around the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and Philip Skopansky had just released a book called Tragedy Plus Time that really exhaustively looked at this one issue. And Daniel Fuentes Morgan had all this book called Cry, Laughing to Keep from Dying. And I read that, and that was sort of formative. And Beck Krefting, who's a comedy academic who has written about a lot of subjects and was a really useful sounding board. And then once you get into it, then I was sort of like doing all this academic search, which was not my plan. And I wanted to bring that to the fore because like there's so many goals of the book, but one is like, okay, goals to take comedy seriously and like to create a foundation of doing so. And part of that is to like shine a light on sort of the work that's already being done. And then I think I also thought it was fun to like, the book just jumps from high to low all the time to like, what are sort of these sort of most esoteric or highbrow references I can do when I'm quoting non-comedy academic sort of philosophers or whatever. And that to me is just so funny. There's such stupid jokes in this book that I wrote while also having like, you know, Heidegger quotes or stuff like that. To me, that's who I am, I guess. So I was like, well, that's what the book should have.
Your love of The Simpsons really shines through in that.
Formative. I'm like, that's what, like, I wanted it to feel like, you know, the goal is like, I want this to feel like a Lisa. I wanted this to feel like a Lisa episode of The Simpsons.
I love that. And I like that you, in your introduction, I feel like the way I've described it is, sometimes you get into a room and lock eyes with my husband, who is a stand-up comedian, and you two get really intense really quickly. And what I'm seeing in this introduction and throughout the book is this is not just for those intense comedy nerds. You really kind of go through the work of defining like what a joke is, for instance. So tell me a little bit about that, because I do think there are plenty of people who say to my husband, like, oh, you're a comedian. Have you heard the one about the blah, blah, blah?
Of the many goals of the book, as I said, was I was just started getting so annoyed with how people talked about comedy who were not comedians or me, you know, and even I was kind of getting annoyed at comedians, but like they just sort of. Words existed, so they throw it around. And you'd hear people say things like, there's not even, like, jokes in this. I don't like it. There's not even jokes in it. And if I went, what do you mean? Right? Because most of the time, they're talking about a sitcom with fewer jokes. And I was like, well, most sitcoms' jokes are not, have you met the blah, 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 they did this and that. Their jokes are characters saying something in a sort of funny way. Or that is indicative of what that character is like. And then jokes is like this, because it's like jokes that you see in a joke books, knock, knock, who's there, chicken across the road is a joke, or a priest, a rabbi, and something went on in the bar. Like those, that word is the same word as what comedians do, but that is not what comedians have done for the last 80 years, or they shouldn't have. Some comedians have started doing it again. I don't understand why. It's probably because of Twitter, but. Those are a different thing. Jokes are a folk tradition. No one knows who writes jokes. They've been studied as folk traditions, right? They're like, you know, there's like books about how dead baby jokes came to prominence during a time when the sort of abortion debate was happening. And as a result, they're like, those jokes were a manifestation of the anxieties, whatever. I find a lot of it inane. But that tradition is related, but not exactly the same thing as comedy, which is an art form, which is a popular culture that is top down. These are people that are creating a thing that reflects who they are as people. And I needed to differentiate because when I say you can analyze comedy, I'm saying you're analyzing an art form. You can analyze artists, people that are expressing themselves. To analyze jokes is really like projection, right? It's just sort of like cobbling together a bunch of different things together. And it felt, you know, the first chapter really had to define the terms, because I do think when I talk to Josh, we can skip like days worth of conversation to be like, oh, did you see how this person opened their special with this one thing? They'd even do like, because we know all the terms, we know what we're talking about, all this. For a lot of people, I understood reading it would have, they watch comedy, but they hadn't really thought about it. And they didn't understand what's happening. You know, I write about how a lot of people see comedians like they're wizards when they're really magicians, right? They see them like magically, they're saying funny things. They're getting up there like me talking, but somehow it's so funny. And really, like, a lot of work is being put into it, even if they're sounding like a person just talking up there. So I wanted to sort of like, the first chapter is really trying to be like, this is what comedy, this is what I mean by comedy. And like, kind of have to get on board with this perception, because I do think, you know, part of calling a comedy book is like, joke books is a tradition, right? So it's like, I think people go into those being like, I'll learn how to say funny things out loud. And I was like, that's kind of not what this is for. No. This is a matter of like learning why you might find something funny that you find funny, or maybe expanding your understanding of a thing that you don't find funny, but you maybe find interesting. And, you know, and then it's a way of doing a workaround of the sort of dead frog stuff, right? The E.B. White and Catherine White quote about how you can't do comedy because you can't analyze humor because it's cutting up a dead frog. And as I explained then, it's like they're kind of talking about a different thing. Like, comedy as we know it didn't exist. The term stand-up didn't exist yet. So they're talking about jokes and they're talking about humor writing. If they saw what we see, they'd be like, yeah, you could definitely talk about that.
I love that. And I think that one of the things that people don't always think about, which I think about a lot because I'm home alone most nights, is that comedians need an audience more than any other art form. And I love that you talked to Sheila Hedy about this, because it's a real literary podcast. Yeah. And she acknowledges that, you know, writing in a room by yourself all day is really hard, but comics have it worse.
Yeah. I mean, I the whole of the many things that runs through the book is this idea of audience. And comedy is an audience-dependent art form, or stand-up is an audience-dependent art form. And I look at it from a few different ways, right? First, I sort of explain what that means, because I don't think comedians get, this is definitely a thing, like, comedians get it and comedy nerds probably get it, but laymen don't really realize what it means when we say comedians write jokes, right? And what most often it means, even the most word-specific comedian you can think of, means they went up with an idea of something they cared about and then said it in front of people enough times that somewhere their brain thought of the perfect thing to say, and they knew it was the perfect thing to say because of how the audience responded. And until the audience responded, they didn't know. And that's the only way it works. And there's so many, you know, the most exciting example I write about in the book is Chris Rock sort of learning who he was as a comedian by bombing for like 5 years.
I didn't know that, Jesse, that he went out with the goal of feeling really shitty.
Well, it's hard to speculate, but it doesn't seem like it makes him feel as shitty as it does other people. You know, like, I think if he went out one time and it worked right away, he wasn't going to be like, well, I got a bomb for 3 more years. I think he just realized, like, he needs to try things, because I think any comedian, it's why just sort of like getting an audience laugh is not enough, because you can sometimes get an audience laugh by manipulating them a lot of different ways. But to get something that can reach more people and it can be lasting demands really paying attention to the sort of gears of how the response is. And I do think, I don't know if this is fun for other people or would be, but like, when I sit, watch a comedy show, I'm watching people perform and I'm watching an audience perform. I'm like, how are they doing? What are they responding to? You know, it's been really interesting the last 3 years, because 3 or 4 years, they've been relearning how to be audiences. Like, I can tell there's like some people are new to the city because they haven't, because of COVID. So they're still new to being an audience, and they're laughing weird, or they're laughing too loud. there's all these different little things that you can pay attention to as part of the show, right? So, and that gets into the sort of the next thing about audiences, which is like, as a result, comedy is an extremely present art form. You go up with something you thought of that day, or you thought of, you might find something on stage and you'll talk about that the entire set. That means as a result, there'll be jokes performed, let alone, you know, written days after 9/11, as I write about in the book extensively, or any national tragedy that happens. It happens over and over again, and even more so. And then audience and Sheila Heady thing. So, and but then so sort of taking that further, right? So the book sort of has different chapters sort of organized by different themes of how comedy operates. And the last chapter is about connection. And I want, you know, that chapter is sort of more personal. It's sort of just more emotional in general. And I wanted to sort of show the sort of practical matter of what this looks like and what they are from each other and how the sort of positive of sort of comedian is sort of that presentness to it. But the difference is, unlike other artists, how their then life is, right? They can't make their work without the audience, right? So what does that mean during a pandemic? And they can't, it's for the most part, it's a thing done alone, not where you live, right? So Sheila Heady says, like, well, at least I can get dinner afterwards or something. And her brother's a comedian. That's part of the reason I asked. And part of the reason I asked is also, like, I had read Pure Color, and that book is, like, somewhat about, like, what it's like to be an artist, right? And I was like, well, comedians are such weird artists, right? And she basically goes, like, it's really lonely. And I write, there's a sort of disconnection that I think a lot of artists have. They sort of are observing the world. And their art is their way of sort of how they see it, or sort of their ways to try to connect to the world. And I say that, like, comedians essentially are, because their art is them, they sort of are carrying that disconnection around with them. And, you know, I'm sure you see it, like, comedians are at where they're at, but they're also not there a lot. It's very hard for comedians to be present. And because they're, as I explained, like, the American comedy tradition, the modern comedy tradition, started with sort of cultural outsiders, so sort of Jews and African-Americans. And then it sort of became an art form for outsiders, just like people who were. And I think this is a long way of saying that it's, how do I put it? There's a price to the sort of the high of what it means to be so connected to that many people in such an immediate way, then has a price where you have the opposite of that, which is, like, you then go to a hotel and you could, like, not be more alone.
Yeah.
Does that resonate?
It sure does.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
But, so let's go back a little bit. Sure. You talked about, you know, comedy post 9/11, and you have a chapter about timing. And if not comic timing necessarily, like how you deliver a line, it's like what's quote unquote too soon. So partly it's just because I love her and I want to involve her in this podcast. But you write about seeing Alison Leiby perform her one woman show about abortion on the day or the day after.
I write about not seeing it.
Yes. First you write about not seeing it.
So yeah, it was sort of interesting. So that chapter at first was only about 9/11. Then I realized it became too distracting. People were like, well, that's your 9/11 chapter, but, you know, and I was like, oh wait, so it needs to be more about how, you know, the book in general is about how comedy functions as an art form, but also how it functions as part of our culture. And so I sort of wanted sort of another example. And it was honestly a thing my partner, Alina, pointed out, because she went to me to that show the day Roe v. Wade was overturned, because it was like a traumatic event for her. And so we went to this show. Day Roe v. Wade was overturned. She didn't want to go to the show. We already had tickets in it. But I was like, they'll talk about it. They're not going to get into it, but they'll mention it exists. because that's what comedians do. They by being a present art form, it means they sort of talk about what is in the air and hopefully maybe relieve some of the weight of it, even for a moment in time, right? And so we go to this show and three male comedians go up and they do not address it at all. Even one talks about politics in a sort of general way. And you're like, well, any moment, maybe they'll just like do an aside. All you really have to do so little. Like, I went to a show the next day. Jay Jordan opened it by being like, look, it's shitty. We all know, but like, we have this next hour and a half together. We can have fun. And that's all you really have to do. And so that didn't happen. So then I was thinking about how I went to the wrong show and or my friend J.F. Harris explained, like, they essentially, it's like malpractice. Like, they didn't do the job of a comedian. And then I realized, like, also in New York City that night, Allison Leiby was doing a show. Like, she didn't know when Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned, but she had a show about abortion and Roe v. Wade was overturned. So I just asked her about what that weekend was like. And it's in those moments that it really is amazing what comedians can give people. Like, you know, Pete Davidson opened SNL recently.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh no. And then he's like, my dad died on 9/11. You're like, oh yeah, this is exactly what you should talk about. Which was like, he just opened SNL and be like, my dad died on 9/11. My mom accidentally bought Dangerous by Eddie Murphy. I laughed for the first time, right? And you're like, I don't know if I'm right there, but essentially it's like the idea that like laughter is the best medicine. And it's like, well, it depends on what is your ailment. If you have like a disease, it's not. Like, there's studies that proven it just does not help. But if what is hurting you is that you cannot laugh about something, if something feels too heavy to move, the thing that comedy can do better than anything else we have so far as a species is make a thing feel lighter. You know, I quote Viktor Frankl, and he's just like, and so Viktor Frankl comes up with this theory, you know, after being in a concentration camp and talking essentially about like how they were able to get through. And he's, and I can look up the exact quote if I'm going to.
That's okay.
All right. Anyway, so basically he goes like comedy can, humor can offer an aloofness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just the ability to sort of be detached from something a little bit, to have it be lighter, is so necessary to sort of like, you both sort of acknowledge the moment and then sort of be able to move forward. And it is like fundamentally like why we have it. It is like why we as a species evolved to sort of figure out ways to make each other laugh, because, you know, tragic stuff happens all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. One thing I wanted to get to is your use of the word fearless. It's often described, it's often used to describe comics who like don't give a fuck. And what you're talking about is comics who are not afraid to be vulnerable. And I think about this specifically because we just saw a pub date for Maria Bamford, Gary Goldman, and Aparna Ancherla. And what a trio of comedians who are in here willing to lay it all out.
Yeah, it's so funny. When I wrote that sentence in the book about how fearless is fine, I was like, well, this is the best sentence in the book. This is the sentence in the book people will remember. And I don't know how we decided to call tough comedians fearless, like comedians willing to offend people, willing to hurt people's feelings. I don't know why, because even most other tough comedians would be like, it's not that hard to do to go up there and say slurs out loud.
Yeah.
And it's partly that it's such an, and it's, and that doing, being that type of comedian is born out of a fear of being vulnerable. Like, that's the thing. It's so fearful to go up on stage and slash out on groups or whatever, because you're so scared someone's going to see you. It is like truly the most baby little, you know, as you describe comedians like this as bad little boys, it's such a little kid thing to do. And it's probably born out of they bombed one time and it was so bad that they never will do it again. So as a result, they're invulnerable, but then they're not expressing themselves. They're not being themselves. And in contrast, I write about Maria Bamford, Tig Notaro, and Margaret Cho specifically. And it's this idea that like, I contrast it with Louis C.K., where it's like, unlike being a perv, like having mental illness can actually hurt you professionally. And to talk about it, to talk about an industry, we might be like, especially with women, be like, oh, she's crazy. We shouldn't work with her. To do that anyway, that is actually to confront, that is to to be without fear, or to understand that it is something to be fearful of and proceeding anyway, because you realize it will help people. That's why they do it, you know, like go help them as well. But really, it's like, now it has become so much more common for comedians to talk about having mental illness. It's just like easy. It's unbelievable. You go to a comedy show, just like, I have this or that. That is like truly a 15-year phenomenon. Like 15 years ago, Maria Bamford's doing, no one else really was doing it to the degree she was. She changed how people, what is normal for to be spoken of. And it wasn't easy. But she knew that is what a comedian can do. It's hard to talk about things. Comedians are good at talking. Jokes make things easier to hear, you know, and the hope is you reorient what we think of as challenging, you know, like the goal is to be like, what, there's good and bad comedy, or well done or hard or easy things. There's easy things to joke about. There's hard things to joke about. And I really want to give people the vocabulary to appreciate the people that are, who are really doing the hard stuff and doing it beautifully, doing it hilariously. But yeah, I mean, like that, I had talked to Gary Aparna and Maria, and it was, and I was like, there are too many comedians talking about mental illness now. And they're like, there can never be too many. Like, they all remember the first time they heard any comedian doing it and how freeing it was. And like, again, it's that being able to joke about something is like such a gift.
And meanwhile, there are comedians out there who complain about wokeness and how they're not allowed to say anything anymore. And a lot of them had great, not great. A lot of them had very lucrative deals with Netflix.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of people are scared, right? A lot of people like being scared. They built such a shell around themselves that they want an artist that reflects that so that they don't have to, they don't have to reflect at all, right? They're like, that's how I talk. That's good. End of story. And I think, and that's a lot of people. It's more people, right? The biggest comedians in the world, and always have been, for the most part, been a lot of people who do stuff like this. And I want people to be able to know that that's not necessarily good. Like I have a chapter about it. I mean, you know, you read the book, but people who are listening might not know. There's a chapter about a lot of the sort of like edginess and whatever. And the goal of that chapter is one, explain why comedians do it at all, right? I feel like people who don't like it don't even know why the comedians are doing it. They just think like, why is this person just going on stage and like complaining about trans? It's so weird. It's like, well, this is the tradition. Like there is an idea. There's sort of like some academic explanation. There's some like hypothetically liberal explanation for why you do it, whatever. And I think it's fair. Like I don't necessarily choose side. But then the goal was like, I don't want to like finger wag and be like, you are bad. I don't like you. You're bad people. I want to be like, this is why your art is worse. You've now become so obsessed with this goal of not doing what people say you can't say that you're now only saying a thing you're not even interested in saying. And again, the goal is like comedy is an art form. So if you're not expressing yourself, if you're not expressing what you care about, instead you're expressing not even what you don't care about. You're expressing just what people are saying you're not allowed to say. And it's easy. Like, that's the thing. Like, it seems hard because you can't go to work and say something that makes fun of transgender people because you have a job that's normal or whatever. So it seems hard to see Dave Chappelle be like, transgender people are bad or whatever he said. Actually, because it's a sensitive subject, it puts so much potential energy into whatever he says or any comedian does, this joke says, that anything you say that is a relief will get a huge response. But that is cheap. That is a cheap thrill compared to like what more interesting comedians are doing.
I love that answer. So maybe a good question to leave you on is, whose comedy is exciting to you right now?
This is useful. I need to remember to write down this because I assume I'll be asked this all the time. I have answers, but I want to make sure I say all of them. Oh, cool. These are the people I'll say. All right. So one, a lot of people. I've been writing about this for 11 years or whatever. And let's say 5 years in, I was like, I think we're done. I don't think there's actually going to be any more good comedians. And then I saw Las Culturistas. And I was like, oh, never mind. Like, we're good forever. Like, it was the most exciting thing I'd seen, like, my entire life was the first time I saw those guys. Right. So then now I know that there's always interesting things. If I don't know anyone new who's interesting, then I'm not doing my job. So here are three people. One, Brittany Carney. She is a comedian in New York. She did this joke. I saw her recently. And it was about being in Japan and watching a infomercial about teaching Japanese people to speak German. And she just sort of like goes through the one sentence they use and try to understand what they mean. It's just sort of like a type of comedy that I had not seen in a while, which is pieces. Like, you're not just doing like a first person autobiographical story. You're sort of like creating a structure and playing in it. And her perspective is sort of so unusual and but so true, and like everything she says only she can do. Then this guy Benny Feldman, he does like one-liners, and I find most one-liner comedians or most short joke comedians I don't say I have an issue with, but I think often they hide behind them. They're it's almost like I'm so good at writing jokes that you didn't realize that I have not revealed anything about myself or how I see the world. And I don't love the math of that. Though I like roast jokes, which is sort of its own context, I don't like just when a comedian just like does a joke up there. I feel like it's a craft, but it's not an art necessarily, which is its own thing. Anyway, so, but a true one-liner comedian, Stephen Wright, Mitch Hedberg, they create worlds in one sentence. And that world is like they are the god of it. And it only makes sense in this. And so Benny Feldman is a comedian of that tradition. He has Tourette's, which I'm sure is probably part of why he does sort of shorter jokes. But he has a joke about the saying, if you teach a man to fish. I think about it all the time. And I it's one of those things that I'm like a little kid where I try to say it, but I'm laughing through it. So I can't get the rhythm right. So just look it up.
Yeah,
it is so funny. And the last one is Francesca De Uva. Francesca De Uva was, I think I might have been one of the first shows after the pandemic that I went to. Pretty Major is a show that Vulture puts on with Union Hall. And they booked Francesca De Uva. I had no idea who she was. And she's like, she just starts introducing a song. I don't know what her song's going to be like. And she's like, I'm a nanny. This is sort of a song about it. And she sings this song about, it's called Nanny Franny. Nanny Franny. And it is like, it was just like the funniest. It like truly, I was crying laughing, like, and I couldn't believe it. It was like a new type of musical comedy I haven't heard. She has a background in like digital music composition. So if you just listen to the music of it, you're like, oh, this is like incredible. It's like a, there's movements and she's playing all the different parts, but it's like a pop song. So all these people really excite me. Comedians rule.
Yes, they do.
Jesse,
before we go, I need more recommendations from you. Give me a book recommendation or two.
Sure. Yes. So no one needs me to recommend books. But so here are books about comedy. Well, two books about comedy and one third thing. So people always recommend Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, when they're like, I'm starting out to be a comedian. I need to read that book. And it's a very good book. I've read it multiple times. I love it. But I actually think Joan Rivers' first book, Enter Talking, is just a better book for a starting out comedian. Because a lot of Steve Martin's book is actually what it's like to be an extremely successful comedian. Right. It's like, oh, it's a story about how one person became one of the most successful comedians that ever lived. And Joan's first book is just up until she gets her break, spoiler alert. And it's rough. Like, she has a very hard time up until the very last page of the book. If you're an audiobook listener, she reads the audiobook, and the ending is so beautiful, how she reads the ending.
Yes.
Side note, if you're an audiobook listener, listen to Martin Short's audiobook. Don't read that book. That book is meant to be performed. It is not a book. It is like only meant to be listened
All
to.
All of the good tips.
Yeah. So, and then one other book, well, one author and book I want to recommend, this guy, Dr. Seuss. Have you read Dr. Seuss recently?
I've heard of him. I haven't really...
Is he... Like, it's one of the hackiest thing to do is like sort of be a white person and take a sort of not rap thing and put like rap slang to it. But it truly is like, I read it and think like this guy has bars or whatever. But his use of language, I've never been more jealous of a writer. So there's this one, this book that I'm reading a lot for no reason called, Oh, the Things You Can Think. So he's just talking things you can think of. And one is, and you don't have to stop. You can think about schlop, 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 beautiful schlop, beautiful schlop with a cherry on top. And I go, that's my favorite page of writing I've ever read. It is so, no one else is doing that.
He knew a thing or two, that guy.
He understood that, like, kids, but really all people. It's definitely kids, but people are like this as well, but people have all this other baggage on them. Like, don't actually need proper nouns of real things. They know what you're talking about. Like, you don't know, like, you have no idea what schlop is based on how I read it. It ends up being, like, I think, like a dessert. But you know that he's describing, you know, meaning out of that. It's in, anyway, so I want to recommend Dr. Seuss. If anyone, like, if you're in a bookstore and you're like, I have, like, 3 minutes to kill, just pick up any of them and you're like, his use of language, I don't know, as I told you ahead of time, it's a real quirky answer, but I was like, truly, he's maybe my favorite writer.
I love that. Jesse, thank you so much. The comedy book is out now. I do want to give a special shout out to your book launch party, which is Tuesday, November 7th at the Bell House, and lots of good people will be performing. I will say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one person we both know fairly well. You yes. might know more than I do, though. And I will be answering questions while eating hot, spicy chicken wings, a la Hot Ones.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah,
for you.
I was just nervous if there's going to be a bunch of comedians that the question and answer part might be boring. So I was like, well, I need to up the tension. But it's at least the host is going to be very handsome.
Yes, that's true. Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.